We first spoke with UC Berkeley sociologist Arlie Hochschild in September of this year as the 2016 presidential general campaign was getting underway. Well, a lot can happen in 14 weeks. We discussed her new book, Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right. Hochschild talks about the friendship she fostered while trying to reach a deeper understanding of conservative America. Concerned with the political divide between conservative and liberal America, she spent the last 5 years talking with Tea Party members in Louisiana. She found that under their right-wing hostility was a sense of alienation and struggle. Well, now that the election is over, we wanted to check in with Hochschild to discuss what she saw while on the ground in the red states and how much November 8th's results surprised her. Arlie Russell Hochschild is Professor Emerita of Sociology at UC Berkeley and author of Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right. Arlie, it's a great pleasure to have you back on the roundtable. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here.
Several months ago when we had you, it was during the heat of the primaries, and we were talking about many different issues. And I wanted to have you back to talk about exactly what happened and how much you saw of this during your travels. Before we get to that, though, talk a little bit about what brought you on this journey in the first place.
In 2011, already, when my journey began, I could feel what many of us were feeling, this tearing apart of the political fabric into left and right, each encased in its own political moral bubble. As a sociology professor at Berkeley, living in the town of Berkeley, I was in one political bubble, but I could see that it was increasingly cut off from a growing political bubble on the right. And so I decided the best thing would be for me to try and find a place in America that's as far right as Berkeley is left, and to take my moral and political alarm system off and to really permit myself a great deal of curiosity about the world of the right, the lives, the experiences, the beliefs that underlie a predisposition to go to suspect government, to think it's always up to bad things, and to be receptive to a messenger such as Donald Trump. At the time, in 2011, of course, 5 years ago, I didn't know that there would be, and they didn't know there would be a Donald Trump. But what I did was to go to the South, because that's where the right was growing the fastest, and to focus on whites. That's who was going right the fastest, older, religious. And I had to figure out where in the South. So I noticed that in 2012, if you look at the proportion of whites who voted for Barack Obama, it was 50% in California. It was a third of whites in 2012 voting for Obama in the whole region of the South, and it was 14% for Louisiana. So Louisiana was the super South. And I thought, that's perfect. Okay, let me go there. And I ended up interviewing some 60 people in all, 40 super Tea Party, around southwest Louisiana, around the petrochemical kind of center of America. They call themselves the buckle in America's energy belt, around Lake Charles. What I went in with was the red state paradox. How could it be that the poorer states, the states with the worst education and medical help, the lowest life expectancy, the most disrupted families, and states that receive more money from the federal government in aid than they give in taxes, how could they be so against the federal government? You know, I just didn't, if you have a problem, don't you want a little help? So that was the paradox. And Louisiana was a super, was an exaggerated version of that paradox, because in 2014, it was the poorest state. It dukes it out with Mississippi for that
right
position. 44% of the state budget came from the federal government, and they were very right-wing, high proportion of Tea Party, and very enthusiastic in the primary and in election they went for Donald Trump. So I went with that question. I went in that mode of trying to really be open and listening in my orientation. So that's why I got there, and that's how I got there.
So let me ask you, and we'll get into the details in a moment, but let me ask you the question in this way, which is following Election Day, on that Wednesday morning, and I think this is a bipartisan statement, which is the political world woke up shocked as to what happened. Were you as shocked knowing what you know and learning, having learned what you learned?
No, I wasn't as shocked, but I have to tell you I did not predict it. But no, I wasn't shocked. I saw the appeal. You know, in a way, I went to the primary rally in New Orleans that Donald Trump held in March, and I went with a Tea Party informant, and we'd spent 6 hours in the car because it was very crowded getting there, lots of people. And I felt at that moment, listening to him and seeing the, you know, Make America Great Again, and the great excitement surrounding him. The only blacks I saw in that crowd were selling Donald Trump T-shirts outside, or were security, or were part of Black Lives Matter protesters that were being thrown out. Otherwise, a very white older group. But feeling the excitement, almost ecstasy, that some people were experiencing there, I thought, I have been studying for 5 years the dry kindling, and now I see the match. In other words, these were people feeling forgotten. They felt like a minority group, actually, of white blue-collar people who were in an economically stagnant and less and less secure, a kind of a sector of society that was going to lose through globalization and didn't see in the Democratic Party any hope of being recognized or focused on. And they did a lot of forgiving of Donald Trump's flaws. I saw them at the beginning. They didn't like him in many, many ways, but it became hugely important to them that they were recognized as a sector, and that bringing jobs back in, even if it was an illusion. And they were aware. Look, he may not be able to fulfill these promises. Mm-hmm. They were very aware of that, but they were that desperate. Yeah. That forgotten.
There were 17 candidates running for president on the Republican line at the beginning of the process. There right. were members of that group who were true Tea Party members, who were very strong in the Tea Party. Why did they not resonate more with the group that you went to explore in Louisiana?
Isn't that interesting? Yes, many of the people that I wrote about in Strangers were Ted Cruz fans and Rubio fans. So they were on the extreme right in their perspective and desires. But I think both of those figures didn't offer what many kind of charismatic right-wing authoritarian leaders do put forward, which is what the journalist Kapuscinski once said, the great yesterday, you know, this holding up of a glorious past and one in which you have a strong leader who's going to, you know, bring back the millennial. It was almost like a secular rapture that I think Donald Trump offered these respect-starved people. And and that, you know, he would lead them up and out of their dilemma. And I don't think Cruz, who offered social values, was a little bit rigid about it, or Rubio, who seemed to receive all the shame that Trump was dumping on him, seemed quite strong enough or powerful enough in their message. He was the PR guy. He had, you know, has power through promise.
Arlie Hochschild is the author of the new book, Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right.
A lot has been said about the media's role. And I'm curious as to how you feel about that, because that often discounts what you have written about in the book, which is the true feelings that people have and the story that so much of the media, right or wrongly, is accused of getting wrong.
Well, I think the media is hugely important, but is not the whole story. I think Fox News and outlets to the right of Fox News offer two things. They offer, first of all, fake information, which leads people to feel, I think, have totally criminalized Hillary Clinton, for example. And, I mean, there's a rumor mill, you know, that even Ted Cruz's father, you know, was in on the assassination of Kennedy. I mean, these are things
right.
Trump put out there and that were picked up and continued. So fake news that rings alarm, you know, it's really an emotional thing. And the second thing that the media offers is reaffirmation. I think we all do that. We tune into the news to kind of have what we already feel reaffirmed. But what it is that's being reaffirmed, I call in the book the right wing deep story. And I think all of us, left and right, have a deep story. And it is this that the media reaffirms. So what's a deep story? It's a story that feels true. You take the information out of the deep story. You take moral judgment out of the deep story. It's just what feels true. And the right-wing deep story, as I describe in the book, is that you're waiting in line as in a pilgrimage. You're facing up the hill. And the top of the hill is the American dream. And your feet are tired. You've waited a long time. You haven't had a raise in two decades. And you're not sure your job is going to last. And so anyway, you're waiting. And then you see these line cutters. Well, who were the line cutters? Somebody cutting in line ahead of you, pushing you back. That would be blacks on affirmative action programs that now have access to jobs formerly reserved for whites. Even worse, women who, like myself, now had access to jobs formerly reserved for men. And then, in their view, in this deep right-wing deep story, the immigrants and refugees and even the oil-soaked brown pelican, you know, an endangered species. I heard a lot of people say, well, now the liberals are putting animals ahead of people, you know. So all of these, quote, line cutters being sponsored by, here's the second part of the deep story, as they see it, Barack Obama was waving to the line cutters. He was promoting and sponsoring the line cutters. In fact, wasn't he a line cutter himself? And then they said, well, but how about us? We're in line, but we're not cutting in line, and we're moving back. So he's not our president. He's not representing our sector. Right. So, and then they felt that, in combination with a general feeling of being marginalized, if they looked around for honor and for a sense of being recognized, they were kind of in trouble. When you said, oh, well, they were proud Southerners, they knew very well that the South was put down as a backward region. One woman kind of put it this way, you know, I know a lot of liberals on the coast, they think of a person like me as backward, uneducated, a Bible thumper, homophobic, sexist, racist, and fat. That's what she said. She just kind of thought, I know, you know, quote, you people are looking down on me. And that hurt, that stung. And so here they are in this deep story, waiting in line and being pushed back and being denigrated as rednecks. In the deep story itself, there's someone ahead of you in line that's turning around and saying, oh, you're uneducated, you're just a redneck. And there was a tremendous amount of resentment at the insult of that. So I put this deep story together, and then I asked the people that I came to know over these 5 years, well, does this ring true to you, or how would you change it if it doesn't? And they said, yeah. One guy said, you read my mind. Another one said, I live your metaphor. So there was a ringing of bells there. Another woman said, well, no, actually, what you have to add is that the people being pushed back in line are paying taxes to sponsor the line cutters. So, you know, they would add and elaborate this deep story. But I think that's what gets reaffirmed when they turn on Fox News. Brett Baer, there's a sense that it feels true to them. So in a sense, you can say that whole conversation the country has had with itself about diversity, it kind of stopped in 1960 in certain regions like the South, and everything else feels every change since then has felt threatening. And I mean, perhaps it's an overstatement, but that's how the media, it's already there in people's sensibility, but the media then just magnifies it, focuses it. And some people have listened to the media as other people go to church, you know, and they feel about the Fox News newscasters that they're kind of like family, that, you know, Bill O'Reilly is daddy. You know, stable, somewhat opinionated. Hannity is the difficult uncle, and, you know, that there's a constellation of characters there that feel like families. So there's a church-like quality, I think, to this right-wing media.
You write about a pastor's wife in the book who calls Rush Limbaugh my brave heart.
Mm-hmm. You know, that was funny. I met her at a meeting of the Republican Women of Southwest Louisiana, which I took to going to. I was first as a guest, and she was sitting across the table, and she said this. She loved Rush Limbaugh, and I thought my first little moment was, oh, my God, you know, he's angry, and I always turn the dial. But then I thought, my second, oh, what a great opportunity. I don't understand this. Let me learn. What is this appeal? And so we met for sweet teas the next day, and we talked about it. And she, you know, what was interesting about that encounter is that she told me, well, Rush Limbaugh, you know, defended her against the feminazis and, you know, the environmental wackos. She used these terms from him. And maybe she just saw my face. Maybe I was, you know, really, I don't know what my face said. Anyway, she said, has it been hard to hear what I said? And I said to her, you know, actually, I don't share these beliefs, but it's not hard at all. I have my alarm system off. And I'm here really to learn and understand something I don't understand yet. And you're doing me an enormous favor of giving me the time and your sharing your experience, and I can't tell you how I appreciate it. And she said, you know, I can turn my alarm system off, too. I do that. I know what you're doing. And then we had that in common. And then she tells me actually what I like about Rush Limbaugh is that he defends me against all these epithets that I just mentioned. So she saw him as defending her against coastal liberals. And then I understood Rush Limbaugh differently, you know? It's he attacked, but he also, in her view, defended.
Arlie Hochschild is our guest. She is a UC Berkeley sociologist and author of the new book, Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right. We'll continue our conversation with her after this short break. Welcome back to the Roundtable. It's a great pleasure to have Arlie Russell Hochschild back on our program in December to talk about the election results and about her new book, Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right. Let's talk a little bit about race and how you feel this plays into this, specifically from what you observed in Louisiana, but then extrapolate to the other areas that surprisingly went red in this campaign.
Yes. You know, I think race and fears and anxieties that whites have about being pushed back and about losing opportunity in the face of new face of the economy is hugely important. But I think it's easy to dismiss the experience of the white blue collar and say, oh, I know who you are. Oh, it's economic, the economic pinch, and it's racial prejudice. And now I get it. I guess what my book adds is, yes, there is race, and it was just written all over the place. Every, you know, there's the Jefferson Davis Bank, and you know, there were freeways named after Confederate generals. And if I visited a cemetery where there was a road, and on one side the grass was nicely mown. That's where the whites had been married. It was not mown on the other side where the blacks were. So there was race written all over the place. People were terrified to speak about it because they thought, and the first time when I brought it up, they would say, well, everybody thinks we're racist. You know, I know you people, you think that. And then they would say, but we're not racist. And I'd say, well, what is it to be a racist? And then they would say, well, a racist is a person that uses the N-word. And I never use the N-word. I'm offended by it. One guy said, if anybody uses that word and they on my Facebook page, I eliminate them. I don't like it. Don't want to be associated with racist. The other definition of racist is somebody who hates blacks. And he said, I've never hated blacks. So he didn't think of himself as a racist. But, you know, when it comes to, for example, Donald Trump's father's policies of renting Trump buildings only to whites, well, he didn't focus on that. He didn't see that more structural expression of racism as front central. And often there were conversations like that where they have a quite narrow definition of racist and didn't think they were and weren't looking at the structural story. So I think race was huge. But, you know, for the blue-collar whites, there's a situation to look at. I think the reason mourning is in the subtitle of my book is that I do think the people that I met, a good number of them, and especially the men, were beneath the anger in mourning. And, you know, it turns out that blue-collar, high school-educated white men have a higher suicide rate and a higher use of alcohol and drug addiction, that there's a sense of coming to the end of something. There are studies that have shown that they are more likely to be divorced or separated from the mothers of the children, less involved with their kids. So there's a kind of a quiet crisis, and they feel that there's no answer on the Democratic side to that crisis. And they feel that the Democratic Party has kind of been taken over by identity politics, and there's just no mention of trying to fix the an economy that is automating their jobs out and robbing them of an opportunity for honor and recognition, especially recognition of as men. I think there's a real crisis in masculinity. So there's race and there's gender in this story.
If you look at noon on Election Day, and I think a lot of people could have looked and said, looked at the polls, had the feeling of what was going on, and said, yes, there's that anger and mourning on the American right, but this and this is going to continue. We were even looking at polls that showed that the Senate could turn, the House could turn Democratic. And then 24 hours later, Hillary Clinton is in a ballroom in New York City conceding the election, and the Senate is Republican, the House is Republican. So is it too trite to say that with that very sudden turn, even though its roots are very deep, that there is now anger and mourning on the American left?
By the way, Hillary did win and it looks like 2.5 million popular votes more than Donald Trump. I would say there's mourning, but and shock, but I think what needs to, what has not yet happened, is a formulation of a strategy, you know, which would turn mourning into intention and action. Robert Reich has suggested that the left needs something like the Tea Party. They need to really get organized and get together, reach out to others, say, you know what, this Democratic Party has had some problems in it. It has not done its job. It calls itself the party of the working man, but why are working men leaving it? You know, maybe we need to really look at this automation and what and training for the jobs that that do exist. Maybe we really do need to try and retain industry here.
That was the Bernie Sanders message.
Exactly. And you know what I discovered in conversations with a lot of people on the right in Louisiana? Friendliness toward Bernie. Oh, Uncle Bernie, they would say. Oh, he's pie in the sky. He's a socialist. We're not a socialist country. But, oh, Uncle Bernie. They felt friendly toward him. So I thought, wait a minute, there are some missing links here. We're off in our enclave, you know, reading the New York Times and talking to each other, and they're watching Fox News and in their enclave. But wait a minute, there are some real common ground that could be found if we looked for it. And I think the shoe is on the Democratic foot to reach out and reclaim some of this common ground. For example, on the environment, one man I interviewed voted enthusiastically for Donald Trump. He had many reservations at the beginning, and Cruz was his first choice. But after that fell, okay, he was a Trump guy. And Trump had said, oh, so the man had lost his entire community and his personal home of 20 years to an industrial accident that I describe in the book. It's Bayou Corn sinkhole, caused by a company that drilled into a bayou and methane gas. It was this extraordinary catastrophe. Methane gas started to rise up, and there were new earthquakes that had never happened, and the place was evacuated, all because of an industrial accident that could have been avoided with regulation of polluters, regulation. But This man was now voting for Donald Trump, whose one clear goal was to get rid of the EPA, Environmental Protection Agency. I thought, okay, this is really at the center of the red state paradox. I don't get this. He became an environmentalist. He now says, gosh, why doesn't the Tea Party care about the environment? You know, that shouldn't be just a liberal cause. So there is some common ground. And actually, this January, I'm going back to visit this man with my son, who is a member of the Energy Commission, David Hochschild, of California, and in charge of renewables. So he's a super environmentalist. And he and Mike are going to sit down. We're going to go for a fishing trip, and I'm going to bring my tape recorder, and we'll just see how can left and right get together on the environment, common ground. So I think that's the kind of work that lies ahead of us.
Arlie Hochschild is the author of the new book, Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right.
And I understand that work, and I think many people who read about this ad nauseum and are interested in it understand that common ground can be reached. The one thing that I will throw out to you, though, as you well know, is that looking at what we have so far being presented to us as an administration, and the very early steps that have been taken just days and weeks before Donald Trump takes office would not indicate that there is going to be much work being done on the Republican side, on the conservative side, to work in common ground on these issues.
I think you're absolutely right. And so I think that we need to really gear up for two simultaneous acts. One is to, and this is really the primary one, to organize collectively to show up as defending the progress America has made over the last 100 years, because we may be faced with an administration that wants to send us back to life a century back for women, for blacks, for us, for a free press. I mean, really, we do have to coordinate. And I think Bob Reich is right to say perhaps organize something like the Tea Party on the Democratic side. So that's one thrust, to defend the progress we've made on diversity and so on. But the other simultaneously should be to say, you know, where's the common ground? Could we reduce, you know, issue by issue and within states, could we reduce prison populations, you know, for example? Well, there were a number of people who said, let's get money out of politics. Okay, can this be done, you know, campaign finance reform? There are a number of things that we can explore. And because I should say that the division in the country really bothered the right-wingers I talked to also. And once you showed them any respect, they were very hospitable and eager, in fact, to explain their perspective and experience. So both strategies, forward and back-reaching.
Having spent the time that you spent in Louisiana and meeting these people and talking to these strangers, how did you react when you heard the broad generalizations of the Trump followers and the Trump supporters as they are racist, they are Nazis, they are people who are uneducated? I'm curious as to, because obviously it's much more nuanced than that, of how you reacted to those portrayals.
Well, first, what I have learned is how to hear news and see experiences from from their perspective, and I saw how insulted they were by these, by being called Nazis and racists, because, as I just mentioned, they don't think of themselves this way at all. And so just name-calling actually doesn't work, you know, in some fundamental way. But at the same time, I have been very frightened to see how easy it is to have a charismatic leader swoop in and ring all the emotional bells of a sector that feels forgotten and unrecognized and in economic trouble and sees itself as declining, that it can make them vulnerable to the appeals of a man who may be heading us toward a fascist regime. I think of his some of his substitutes who've said, well, the managing editor of the New York Times should be in jail, you know, because he printed an article about leaked information on Donald Trump's tax returns that showed that he probably hadn't paid taxes for 20 years. So, okay, you have a negative information about a candidate, and that candidate then wants to put in jail the man who permitted this, the publication of that article. Well, we've seen that in fascism. You know, this is Orban in Hungary has just shut down the free press. So I think there is very big danger possible here. And I see people for whom, the people I came to know in Louisiana, blue-collar right-wing, are not looking at that and are not thinking that's bad in the same way that I do.
Do you think there will come an understanding that there is a hypocrisy that many of us see, meaning that you have a candidate who has won people who have voted in the Tea Party, who has won with conservatives and yes, even people who were sympathetic to Bernie Sanders and even we've learned in exit polls who supported Barack Obama. And yet people who look at him, will they eventually see a hypocrisy, especially a group that was once called the Christian right, of looking at someone who has, and I don't want to judge the character, but look, there are certainly all of the things that you would say of a man that has been divorced many times, that of what he has said about women, very unchristian-like things.
Yeah, who is ridiculed a disabled reporter. Yeah.
Yes. So all of that does now, it certainly didn't happen in the campaign, but do you think that it will eventually become that they see a hypocrisy? And also, and I guess I'll bundle this question with another one, which is, how patient are they going to be to see the change that they sought when they cast their vote on November 8th?
Yeah, I think they're going to be very patient, and because they've already made a compromise decision to vote this guy into office. So I don't depend on that. But what I would like to do is to see a lot of crossover discussions. This Joan Blades of MoveOn.org has an organization called Living Room Conversations, gets left and right people together. They break bread together. Where can be the common ground? I think we could do that through churches, through schools, kind of a reach out where you can get to a conversational level of respect and trust where people in the room are saying, you know what, none of these leaders look great to me. You know, we have certain goals. Who would be the best person to move forward with these goals? You have your deep story, I have mine. But we can agree on certain things. And maybe Trump isn't the guy, you know, then who else? Maybe Hillary Clinton isn't the candidate, but then who else? If you can get to a conversation at that level, I think people will not feel forced further into the right. They will feel more friendly toward some cooperation. So I guess I'm saying we need one part of the move forward is to prevent an embitterment in the right, that the more they get insulted, the more embittered toward the left, the more they give up on the left, and show no disinterest in common ground, no interest in it. And the left itself can be very isolated and inward turned. I think that's been a problem. So I don't count on a quick disillusionment in this group. But the more the left speaks up, not insulting the right, but affirming goals that the right can agree with, you know, diversity, for example, you know, support for education for young people so that they're trained for the jobs that are there. And the more affirming of good goals that are likely to attract the right, that appeal to values that the right already has, the better, I think. But a lot of things that look like progress to the left actually kind of turn the right off, and we don't even know it.
Arlie Hochschild is the author of the new book, Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right.
I'm struck by something you were talking about. You mentioned it a couple of times during the course of our conversation as we draw to a close, and that is regarding a statement by Robert Reich about the importance perhaps on the left of there being a Tea Party type movement, and we see that, I would assume, as a progressive movement. And I certainly understand the call for that. I do ask you, though, the question, does the left then risk becoming a more fractured, which we have certainly seen in the history of the Democratic Party, a more fractured party where it is difficult for it to get its act together?
I think we can't start with that fear. I think we have to get started mobilizing people, getting people out of their shock and sense of retreat and saying, no, this is my country. This is I'm an American. I want to be proud of being an American. Here's what I stand for. Who in my community, you know, my union, my church, my school, my neighborhood agrees with me? Can we, you know, I think MoveOn.org is a great organization. I think there are 8 million people, and you sign up, you can see what's going on. You can join a living room conversation, for example. If they're, you know, Muslims are being harassed and insulted and having their scarves pulled off at a parking lot in your neighborhood, you get together with, you know, 1,000 people, and you kind of say, you know it, very peacefully, this is not okay. We're American. It's not a crime to wear a scarf. To stand up and do it collectively, and if there's a party name attached with this collective action, great. You know, I think you can't start with the fear of division. You have to start with active, peaceful, patient, local level organizing.
I ask this question as my final question, and I guess I ask it on behalf of many of our listeners who write in, and many on the left who, as you say, are yes, in shock and are retreating. But a two-part question is, do you understand their fear and their being scared? And as we go into a new year of 2017, can that be a healthy emotion to energize some of the things that you just discussed?
It can. Fear can be a very important engine of activism, and I think it's completely appropriate to this political moment. And I think the first thing you feel is fear, and sometimes fear can lead to a desire to flee, right? But I think we can't do that. We have to hold each other's hands, be in community. That's hugely important, to be in community and say, you know what, we have to stand our ground and organize. So fear, but without flight. You know, I heard a story recently of a couple who said, oh, Donald Trump is now in power. I'm going to go to New Zealand. And there was a couple who had lived, had left when George Bush was elected, mm-hmm. and had gone to New Zealand. And I said, oh, we've come, we're going to come and join you in New Zealand. But the George Bush couple said, no, actually, now that you're faced with Trump, we're coming home to help fight.
Well, the name of the book is Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right, A Journey to the Heart of Our Political Divide. The book is published by The New Press. Arlie, I can't tell you how much I enjoy speaking to you. It's a pleasure, and I thank you very much for your knowledge and for your sharing with us.
And thank you, Joe, for some very probing, important questions.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much. Arlie Russell Hochschild is Professor Emerita of Sociology at UC Berkeley. The name of the book, once again, Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.